Okay, afternoon on 5/13, May 13th. You guys are in on time, so we're starting on time. That's the way it works. And everybody else who's jumping in can jump in. That's what happens when you're here on time. So I've got a problem up here, and I'm pulling problems from that practice sheet that I worked out. And I'm going to try to reproduce what I did in the morning. For the most part, so that everybody gets the same experience or gets the same problems. But if you guys have questions that take me in different directions, by all means, ask those questions and let's explore those different directions, because that's always what I strive to do. I like to try to get those questions answered. So we've got a question here that has an alcohol. Oh, Finley, dude, they were so quiet during all office hours. The office hours were just like silent. And then all of a sudden I start class and they decide that they need to bark. So I'm going to close my office door. Maybe that will quiet him down somewhat. Or at least he's not barking in my microphone then. Okay. Let's try to diagram this one out. We have a tertiary alcohol that's here. So tertiary substrate. No good leaving group as a hydroxyl. But once it's protonated, we do have some acid that's present here, so we can protonate it. We have a polar protic solvent. And what looks like a high temp. And what I found from lecture is that I really liked what we did in lecture. That's notes from office hours. Where did it go? That's from this morning. I have to keep going down. There we go. That's what I want. I really liked this concept. And it's interesting in that I have never used this concept before, or I've never tried to organize them in this way before. In terms of looking at the different substrates and thinking about the different substrates, and this sort of highlights the idea of why substrate is of primary importance or most importance most of the time, is that substrate throws me into different classifications, and that some substrates just don't do certain reactions very easily. And so once I get into a tertiary substrate and I'm in a box, it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm stuck in that box per se, but that's my starting spot to look at everything else that's going on. Because in that tertiary substrate, SN2 is really sort of off the table based on tertiary substrate. And now I can look at the other things that are going on and I can ask, well, what else can happen here? So I can say, well, do I have a bulky or strong base? And no, I'm an acid. I don't have a bulky or strong base. And so E2 is really off the table. Then I can look at this and say, well, what else can be going on here? And this one makes the decision a little bit difficult. It asks, you know, I'm in carbocation territory here. And the question is, am I going to get SN1 or E1? And really the answer to that is that the high heat promotes the elimination. And so we could put over here high heat. That's going to put us into the E1 category. No anions puts us into the SN1 category. And while there are no anions in this reaction over here, I would just get replacement by water and there would be no reaction if I were just getting replacement by water. And the high heat is really promoting elimination. If this were a lower temperature, somewhere around 25 degrees, then I might start thinking substitution in some ways. But the high heat nature of this is really pushing me towards E1. And so I'm seeing this really as an E1 reaction. in the way that I'm trying to diagram that out. And that doesn't leave me a whole lot of room. Now that we've decided, maybe what we'll do is we'll do this. We'll take this and we'll say, all right, this is an E1 reaction. Now that we know that this is an E1 reaction, let's grab this and we'll put it here and we'll finish out this reaction. So in an E1 sense, what's going to happen is I'm first going to protonate the alcohol. And once that alcohol is protonated, I've created a good leaving group. That leaving group can leave, leaving behind now the tertiary carbocation. And from that tertiary carbocation, there are a number of different possible protons that can be pulled. In order to generate products. So each one of these, I would say, is an HA, and each one of these an HB. So I have two different types of protons. And I can look at the two different products that come out of that. So as those two products come out of that, I'm looking at minus HA and minus HB. Mechanism-wise, when a base comes in and pulls that proton, electrons are going to click in and make the double bond. So I get that product. And if I do the same thing for HB and I pull HB and electrons push in, then I'm going to get the double bond in that location. And now what we have is a situation where I have two different types of substitution patterns. I have a disubstituted and a trisubstituted. And given my high heat, the tendency is towards the trisubstituted. And so we would say that the product here would be major. This is my thermodynamic product, leading towards the more substituted. And minor for the less substituted. This is the kinetic product. And so that's the way that that product would break down. Let me ask if there's any sort of questions in terms of what's going on there.
Yeah, so you have HA and HB, right?
Yeah.
But HA is trisubstituted, or HB is trisubstituted, even though there's two substituents, and HB, or HA is disubstituted, even though there's three substituents.
Okay, so be careful in the way we're looking at the product and deciding on how substituted the product is, not the starting carbocation. So when we look at substitution patterns, I'm looking at how many carbons are connected to the double bond. So if my double bond is here, I only have two carbons connected to it. That means disubstituted. The double bond being in this location, I have 1, 2, 3 carbons connected to it. That is trisubstituted. That is different than looking at the starting material over here. So if I clean up that starting material and don't make it quite so complicated with all of the images that I have going on in there, there's the carbocation, there's proton A, and there's proton B. This makes it perhaps a little less cluttered and a little easier to see what's going on. the proton, which is HA, is a primary proton. So HA is sitting on a primary carbon. And when I make that double bond, the double bond will form between these two carbons, and that becomes disubstituted. Proton B is sitting on a secondary carbon. And when I pull that proton, the double bond forms here, which will give me a 1, 2, 3 trisubstituted product. So it is the substitution pattern of the product versus the degree of the carbon on which the proton sits that I think that you may be confusing in your language.
Yeah, thank you.
Does that help?
Yeah, yeah, you basically did that. Cool, awesome.
Awesome. Anybody else? All right, we're ready to do another one? Ready to move on? Okay, let's see. Let's do this. Okay, so give me an idea of what type of reaction we might be looking at here. Are we looking at an SM1, E1, SM2, or E2? What do we think? Eric, SM2? Anybody else want to venture to throw out an answer? Anybody agree with Eric or disagree with Eric? Let's grab this concept. Maybe I can go to my fast switcher. Let's grab these guys again. Actually, let's just grab the one for what we need. What we had was a substrate. Oh, come on. Why can't I get back to, wow. Okay, I don't like the fast switcher anymore. Forget the fast switcher. That's just confusing me. What we have is a secondary substrate. Secondary benzyl. And as a secondary substrate, what I wanna do is I wanna grab the secondary substrate sort of diagram and sit down and think about where we are in terms of a secondary substrate. So in classifying each of the things out, we can look at the solvent. The solvent is protic or aprotic? Do you recognize THF? Can you recognize that as being that solvent? So what is it, Ellen? So this is aprotic. Which is putting us in the area down here. So when we look at, we're doing sort of a dividing line between, there it goes. Can you figure out why it wasn't working? We're doing sort of a dividing line between protic and aprotic. So we're in the aprotic side, we're down on this side. So as we're down in this side, now I'm asking, what's the difference between these two? I've got a good nucleophile versus a bulky or strong base. So what is LDA? LDA is that base which looks like that guy.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah.
Should we recognize THF and LDA as those?
I think that Yes, I'm gonna. I was hoping that as we've gone through these over the past week, that we get more familiar with the different solvents and the different groups. Although, Colin, what I will say is that if we go, where do I want to find it? I want to go to here and the magic sheet, which I should just put on speed dial, additional resources, magic sheet. Oh, THF is not on here. I was looking to see solvents which promote SN2 versus E2. THF should be on here. And if you have a magic sheet that you have been using and have sitting next to you, then you really should just write THF into the solvents which promote SN2 and E2 bimolecular. That THF deserves to be on there. And as far as LDA, here, let's do it this way. These solvents are so common that I don't know why I didn't have them in here to begin with. But what we should have is tetrahydrofuran. That's THF that sits over there. And in terms of the bulky bases, maybe what we should do is here, we should write LDA and we can give it structure because it's kind of helpful to be able to see that. That's lithium diisopropyl amide. And we can use potassium tertiary butoxide. The tert goes over the butyl, so it's KOTBU. This is the anion and the cation, and these two are both bulky bases. That they're not nucleophiles, that they're bulky bases, and that they're going to function as a base rather than as a nucleophile. So recognizing those two as bulky bases separate from the other nucleophiles is an important thing to recognize as well. So we're really looking for those names because they get used as their names more than they get used anything else. LDA, potassium tert butoxide, and the concept that those are bulky bases, and then the tetrahydrofuran, the THF that's there. I think those are good things to if not have memorized, at least have on the magic sheet and have sort of ready to go so that you know where they are. And so that sets us here that this is a bulky base and puts us down into this category onto the E2 reaction, that this is set up as an E2 reaction. And even though the benzyl, secondary benzyl, and we look at benzyl, we typically think of benzyl as being like a primary substrate and a good SN2. So benzyl usually is very good for SN2, but it's the bulky base that becomes more important. That the base that I have can't function as SN2. And how do I distinguish that from Eric, you had up there cold. Yes, it was very cold. And tertiary, secondary, not tertiary. The SN1 nature would say no anions. So if I was looking at SN1, I'd really want no anions in order for it to be into the SN1 category. And, oh, Matt, sorry, that was you. I thought I saw, you're right. Sorry, Matt. So those are the differences that I'm looking there for. Yes, it is very cold, but that relative temperature, when we say cold, when you do minus 78 degrees Celsius, this is very cold, but we use minus 78, particularly when we use LDA to control exothermic reaction. So there are certain conditions that we do that are specific to certain reagents, not specific to a product that we're trying to create. LDA, for instance, when it pulls a proton, generates so much heat that when it pulls a proton from something that has a leaving group on it, kicking in and making the double bond, that this thing generates the diisopropylamine, generates the double bond, and generates just a ton of heat. And we take it down to minus 78 degrees in order to control the amount of heat that's being evolved. So you can't look at the temperature and say, oh, that's a cold temperature, therefore I'm getting substitution. And minus 78 is so cold, I can only get substitution because that's not hot at all. But you're using the minus 78 to control the exothermic nature of the reaction with LDA and not to try to affect the product in terms of what product you're trying to get. We see that there with LDA. The other temperature that we commonly do is minus 30 degrees Celsius. And this also looks like it's fairly cold, but we do that when we use potassium tert-butoxide for the same reasons, to control heat. So when you have these bulky bases, you tend to use colder temperatures to control the bulky bases, not because you're trying to push the mechanism in a different direction. I think that's an important sort of concept to see there. So the cold, we're almost ignoring because that was about the base. And the two things that are standing out to me are really the aprotic nature of the solvent, which is putting me into this category. And then the bulky base, the LDA, is the other big thing, which is leaning me over this direction into E2. So this is truly an E2 reaction. And then once we've got it as an E2 reaction, then we've got to figure out what the product is. So as an E2, we've got to pull a proton, which is anti-periplanar to the leaving group. And fortunately, with this substrate, there is only one type of proton. There is the proton that is, actually there's two, but I guess we can be clear here that these are HA and HB, and that the HAs, when a base pulls them, the electrons push in and I get the double bond, which comes from the terminal end of the molecule. So I get that. That's pulling HA. Looking at pulling HB, you actually can't pull HB. HB can't be anti-periplanar. HB is geminal to the leaving group. Geminal meaning on the same carbon, and therefore it is not an appropriate proton to pull. A proton which is on the same carbon as the leaving group. And so we only get one product. What's the wrong color to write that in? We only get one product coming out of this because we only have one proton that can be anti to the leaving group. And there's no protons on the aromatic ring or on the carbon that is the attachment to the aromatic ring. There's no protons on that to be able to pull to create a double bond there. And if we tried to do that, if we tried to draw this, it looks okay on paper to draw it until you realize that what you have when you start counting out, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in the double bonds. You have 5 bonds to carbon. So when we count out all those bonds, and I guess the one way that I could count those out better is I could count them out this way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's 5 bonds to carbon that are there. And so that product is not a viable product.
Hey, Jason?
Yeah.
When we're showing the part where the base is taking the hydrogen?
Yes.
Can we just, like, I mean, I don't know what THF looks like. Can we just draw B and showing it, pulling it off?
You can just draw B and show B pulling it off, and I'm fine with that. The actual base that is pulling it off is not the THF, but the LDA.
Oh, the LDA, I meant, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the LDA that is pulling that proton off. And it's fine to use the general base, to use B. The only time that that's going to get you in trouble is when you have multiple protons that can be pulled. For instance, if I had a leaving group on a molecule, and I have a proton out here, and 3 protons out here, and I look at using LDA. And the base, I say, is going to pull one of these protons and push in. And so I will get one product. That looks like this, and the base pulling the proton out here and pushing in, kicking out the leaving group, which leads me to another product. And I just use B. B loses the fact that the base was LDA and that this was a bulky base. And so in that it's a bulky base, the sterics come into play in that the protons that are here, these protons are all primary. And the proton that is here is tertiary. And so there is great sterics around that tertiary proton, and the bulky base can't get in through those sterics to be able to get to that proton, whereas the bulky base down here has easy access to the protons, making this the major product. With LDA, change the base, go to a smaller base, if the base equals something else.
I think you add an extra line to your minor product. Up there, like the, when the.
Right, I did. This one goes away, thank you. If the base is a smaller base, say sodium methoxide, so this is small, then this guy becomes major with the small base. And so it's important that if you're going to use B, that you understand the size of your base that you're dealing with and the selectivity that comes along with either the bulky base or a small base.
In this instance, this reaction is a E2 reaction, right?
Right.
Do we still look at the subs of the double bonds down there that we drew? Oh. The example that you were giving me?
Yeah, well, that's where the selectivity is coming from in part, is that your substitution pattern is such that when I look at the substitution pattern, this is tri-substituted versus mono-substituted. And the tri-substituted is more stable, but when you use a bulky base, you can't get it because the proton is too sterically hindered in order to be able to get it. So,
would it still be hard to get it if you were to use that small base because of the low heat we're using? Or would we assume that we would be using a higher heat?
I think this is irrelevant of heat to a degree. So what I would say is let me show you a couple of different examples. Let's see if we can make this stand out a little bit more. I think I put a group there and there and the bromide here. Let's use sodium methoxide OCH3 in THF at 0 degrees C. This is an elimination. This is an E2 reaction. These are all going to be E2 reactions. The other one, make this faster. Copy, paste, paste. Let's choose this one to be at 68 degrees. So let's maybe make this 60 degrees Celsius. And then let's change the base down here to LDA. And we'll do it not at zero, but we'll do it really cold, minus 78. And so the differences are small base, low temp. That with a small base and a low temp, we're trying to get the kinetic product. So there are two products that come out. We have the kinetic versus the thermodynamic. And we can look at each product. So we have the kinetic and thermo. The kinetic product becomes the major product under the low temp. And then when I increase the temperature, and actually I'm going to make this so it stands out a little bit more. Major kinetic at low temp. Major thermo at high temp. And then when I look at LDA, the one that becomes major under the LDA is irregardless of temperature, because I can turn the temperature up on this if I'm careful in how I do my addition. And so maybe we do LDA at something that's a relatively high temp. Let's try and do it at 25 degrees C, which would be high for LDA. And I'm still going to get the kinetic being major because these guys with LDA, which is a bulky base, is controlled not by temperature, but by the bulky base. So these guys are controlled by sterics. When I switch to the bulky base, these are steric controlled. And the sterics push me more towards the primary proton rather than the tertiary proton. I was about to put that proton in the wrong spot. Rather than the tertiary proton. Let's do it this way. This is tertiary and let's make this guy more easily accessible. Easily accessible sort of reads blue to me. So this is a primary proton, and the primary proton has less sterics. And that proton leads to that major product that looks like it's kinetic, but with the LDA, that's all I can get. And that happens irregardless of temperature. But when I'm looking at the small base is more controlled by temperature. And so whether I get kinetic versus thermodynamic is more temperature controlled. So whether I get kinetic versus thermodynamic is more a factor of temperature than it is of the bulky base or like the bulky base.
Yeah, so you answered my question completely. I just thought at first that you were gonna you weren't gonna say that temperature mattered, but you did answer the question, and that is what I expected.
Yeah, cool. That's good. Thanks for that question. Yeah, that's the thing, is that the difference, there's so many nuances with these. It's just like, this is something that you can spend so much time on because there's so many nuances that when you switch from small base to bulky base, all of a sudden temperature doesn't matter anymore with the bulky base in terms of its selectivity, because its selectivity is governed by its sterics. Whereas with a small base, the selectivity is governed more by the temperature, in terms of whether you're going to get a kinetic versus a thermodynamic product, because the small base doesn't care about sterics. It can get into the tough spot and it can get into the easy spot. And so what it pulls is more related to temperature and the activation energies that are related to each one of those transition states. And so that's a great sort of lead in to that. Good. Okay. Unless there's more questions on that, let's pick it up with another one. Let's see what we can do. I feel like I kind of did this morning, but it bears repeating. It's a different problem than what I looked at this morning, but it has similar reagents. And so a lot of the things that I chose to do this morning in lab were about showing some diversity of different reagents and getting you guys to see some different reagents and possibilities in things. Okay, so we're in a tertiary substrate, tertiary benzyl, but tertiary nonetheless. By the time we get to a tertiary benzyl, tertiary benzyls like to go into carbocations because they've got a lot of resonance stability. So those carbocations sort of take me SN1, E1 in that route. But this guy over here leads me to a good question of what this is. Oh, also tertiary, I guess tertiary, I can't really exclude E2 either because they can go E2. Sodium hydride. Is the reagent that we're looking at there. And as a hydride reagent, what we've said is that hydride reacts with protons by pulling the proton in order to generate H2. Which leaves the reaction vessel. And so sodium hydride tends to function as a base and limits some of your possibilities in terms of the reactions that we could be considering. Also, THF is aprotic. And so that aprotic is really supporting SN2 and E2. It's not allowing for carbocation formation. It shuts down the SN1, E1 route. These guys are shut down because the carbocation can't be supported. in a solvent like that, so no carbocation. So that shuts down our SN1 and E1s, makes them go away. And the nature of this base is that it tends to function more as a base than it does a nucleophile. So when we look at SN2 versus E2, it really kind of shuts down SN2 as well and leaves me open to just really the E2 reaction. So yeah, Colin, E2, exactly. So that's how we're sort of looking at this. And as an E2 reaction, then what we're looking at is, well, where are there antiprotons that I can pull to kick out this leaving group? And the protons that are here are all out on these two methyl groups. That's where my protons are located. And so that hydride then, and they're all equivalent. They're all HAs. They are all identical and lead to identical products by pulling each one of them. So the hydrogen or hydride pulls the proton, kicks out the leaving group, and I get only a single product that comes out of this. And that's the only product by E2. Okay, so that's a little bit easier one. The only thing there that's unique is the sodium hydride and understanding hydride as a base so that it doesn't look odd when you see it, because it's not like any of the other nucleophiles that we've dealt with or the other bases that we've dealt with. It's sort of a unique base, but comes up once in a while. And it's primarily used for deprotonations. It's not generally used as a nucleophile. And it's, Jason? Yeah.
I don't want to waste too much time on this question, but it's a quick, curious question. We work with a lot of rings. Are the rings ever really affected by any of these reactions?
Oh, that's a good question. I like that question.
You don't have to show an example, but...
No, I mean, that's a great question.
I didn't want like a yes or no.
Let's look at this one. We do work with a lot of rings. But we need to distinguish the type of rings that we're thinking about. Let me put a OTS out here. And let's do this with let's do a sodium SCH3 and THF. And do it at 0 degrees C. Do the rings ever react? So first off, the question is about rings. And I would like, and do they react? Because we've got a couple of different types of rings. This type of ring, which we call aromatic, where all of the carbons are sp2. And then we've got cyclohexane, which the cyclohexane, while it may have a double bond within it, most carbons are sp3. So we could have a double bond within the cyclohexane ring or not. Sorry. Oh, once my dog started barking, it's difficult for my brain to function. I thought I shut my door, but I think my dog's actually opened my door. Okay. Elian, this is a good question. It's a good question to tackle, because the question becomes, where do I see these reactions? And for all of the all of the reactivity that I am looking at, SN1, SN2, E1, E2, I'm looking SN1, SN2, E1, E2 on SP3 carbons. Never SP or SP2. Once the leaving group leaves, and it leaves behind the carbocation is SP2 hybridized, but the original reaction started at an SP3 hybridized carbon. And so when I look at the aromatic ring, which is SP2, the SP2 nature of this tells me that I'm not going to see reactivity at these. In other words, this group, the bromide, on the SP2 hybridized carbon is not a leaving group. It's a decoy. Don't fall for the decoy. The actual leaving group is going to be on the SP3 hybridized carbon. And that's going to be your actual leaving group.
Isn't OTS just also like a stronger leaving group than bromide?
It is, but I could flip this. So I could have put the bromide over here and the OTS over here, and it makes no difference. So still, the OTS then becomes not a leaving group. It becomes a decoy. Whereas the bromide is the actual leaving group. It's about the hybridization of the carbon, not about what group it is. I think actually your question, Finn, just made that crystal clear and allowed me to change that. So thank you for that question. It is about the hybridization of the carbon, not what the leaving group actually is, that is more important. So on aromatic rings, we see no reactivity for these reactions. Not reactive. Whereas the cyclohexane rings, yes, we'll see reactivity on the ring system itself. And so that's a couple of great questions that are there. Oh, by the way, this was set up as an SN2 reaction, and this SN2 reaction, as it runs forward, gets replacement by the methyl sulfide, and the OTS that was sitting out on the ring system stays out on the ring system and is not reactive because it's at an SP2 center. Now, this is not to say that the SP2 centers can't react. There are two different reactions at SP2 centers. One is called electrophilic aromatic substitution, and the other one is called nucleophilic aromatic substitution. SNAR, substitution, nucleophilic aromatic, and electrophilic aromatic substitution, I guess it's SNER. Those two reactions we study later, and they require different sorts of conditions in order for reactivity at those positions. So we'll see those later, but we won't see those right now. So for right now, we're ignoring the aromatic ring systems. Okay, so that's a great question to clarify.
Wait. So on that one, the reaction was SN2. It was a substitution.
Yeah, SN2, because it was a primary leaving group. We were on a primary benzyl.
Oh.
Super fast SN2 reaction. Plus, you had an aprotic solvent. Plus low temp. Plus really good nucleophile, and a good leaving group. All of that was all set up for a really nice SN2 reaction.
I thought THF was a bulky base though.
No. THF is the solvent, not a base. So THF is the ether solvent in a 5-membered ring system.
So oh, got it.
THF tetrahydrofuran. This is THF. It comes from the name. The name is a cool name. When you look at furan, furan is the aromatic five-membered ring. So this is furan. And the other one is called tetrahydrofuran. The furan comes from the five-membered ring system, but if you look at this guy, it's got just four hydrogens in the formula. This one has four additional hydrogens. And so the four additional hydrogens is where the tetra comes from. Tetrahydro, four extra hydrogens than furan. That's where the THF name comes from. And so THF is just an ether solvent.
Real quick.
Yeah.
Why use THF over something like diethyl ether?
The reasons are numerous. Diethyl ether has a boiling point that is about 33 degrees Celsius. THF has a boiling point that is about 68. It's a little bit easier to handle because of its boiling point, and you can heat it to a slightly greater degree. THF has more sterics because of the way in which these arms flop around. And so the polarity of THF is a much smaller dipole moment, whereas the polarity of THF is a greater dipole moment in the THF. There's no rotation about the ring system and there's less sterics about it, so it's better at chelating, which means that it's better at solvating nucleophiles. Things like sodium methoxide, OCH3, and sodium ethoxide, and all of those anions that we would want to put into solution are better chelated by THF. LDA in particular, lithium diisopropyl amide, is much better supported by THF than it is by diethyl ether because of the stronger dipole moment of the diethyl ether. So it's a combination of those factors. Another good question. Okay. They do. The arms flop around on that. And there's also another component. It's not just the arms flopping around. It's the ring strain that is created that when we look at the lone pairs on oxygen, these are all just sort of cool concepts to think about, that the bond angle here is a bond angle that is like around 105 degrees, which makes these lone pairs accessible to some degree. But in the THF, this bond angle is less than 105. And I don't know if it's 103 or 102 or 101. It's probably somewhere around like 101, which puts a larger coefficient on the lone pairs, which makes the lone pairs more Lewis basic. They're a stronger Lewis base. Due to the constrain of the ring system itself, which also makes it a stronger chelator of cations, to be able to support cations in solution, to drag their anion components into solution with them. So it's a combination of all of those factors. And as you dig into organic chemistry, the structural things that just get more and more cool as you dig into the minutia that you hadn't really thought about, ring strain, back strain, coefficients on lone pairs being more or less accessible, all of these things affect chemical reactions and rates of chemical reactions and ability of solvents to be able to do certain jobs. And there's just an infinite amount of diversity and coolness within organic chemistry that it only gets more cool the longer you study it. It's just fascinating to me. So I love those components. Okay, let's grab another reaction here. Let's not do a five-member ring system. Oh, and also the question to ring systems, why do I keep bringing so many ring systems in? Because ring systems abound within organic chemistry, and I find them a little bit easier to initially focus on than linear molecules. That yes, we can do linear molecules all over the place, but linear molecules can be drawn in many different conformations. And ring systems sort of limit that, and they're a little bit easier to focus on and to initially draw than a lot of the other bigger, larger, linear types of molecules that can go all over the place. So there's less creative ways to draw them, which makes it a little bit easier for the novice and the beginner to focus on what's actually going on within the ring systems. So I tend to favor them for that reason. But we'll do quite a few linear things too. All right, let's react this with potassium bicarbonate in methanol at 60 degrees Celsius. So first off, the chloride is sitting on this carbon, and that makes this a secondary chloride. So my leaving group is the chloride ion, which is an okay but not great leaving group. It's sort of one of the weakest of the leaving groups that we've got, but that's all right. We're on a secondary substrate. So if we're thinking secondary substrate, then I can go and I can grab I'm finding these almost easier to work from than going all the way back to the magic sheet. So we can grab this idea and we can say, all right, well, where are we in the secondary substrate? And remember that there's a dividing line. It's kind of a nice dividing line between protic and aprotic. So let's think about protic as being here and aprotic as being there. And the solvent that I'm in happens to be a protic solvent. So I am on the top side of this, which means that I've already now split my decision between SN1 and E1. But as I split that decision between SN1 and E1, I've got to look at what the difference is. No anions, good leaving group. Anion, high temp. So do I have an anion? Because the difference seems to be no anion versus anion. So the question is, well, what is this?
It's an anion.
It is, good. So potassium bicarbonate is an anion, and that potassium bicarbonate, potassium is the cation portion, but it is the bicarbonate HCO3, which is the anion portion. And so SN1 is off the table, and I have made my decision as an E1 reaction. So this is going to be an E1 reaction mechanism. Now that I've made my decision, now I've got to go through and do the E1 mechanism and see what comes out of it. Any problem there in terms of that decision making or how I made that decision? Okay, so let's go and let's grab that substrate and let's do the E1 mechanism on it. Let's start it off here. So in an E1 mechanism, what I'm going to do is first off, kick out the leaving group. When we kick out the leaving group, we go to the carbocation, which is the secondary carbocation. From the secondary carbocation, I ask the question, since this is secondary, are there any more stable carbocations that are a shift away? So I'm looking for hydride or alkyl shifts. And yes, there is. There is an alkyl shift that can occur here. And so I will then take that down to a new carbocation. And we only do this once. So we only do the one shift. And then once we do the one shift, now it's time, and this is tertiary now, now it's time to look at the different products that can be created. So everything that comes from the minor one, from the secondary, these are all going to be minor products. And the ones that come from the tertiary, one of them is going to be major, maybe not all of them. But now the question is, I get products that come out of both. And so I need to start looking at the different products that can come out of both. So in terms of this, I have protons, which are located alpha to the carbocation. These are HAs. They're both the same. And then with the tertiary carbocation, I have a proton which is here, which we will call HB. I have protons which are on here, which we can call HC. And there's one more proton here, which we'll call HD. So I've got four different possible products that can come out of this. Let's look at these guys as HA, HB, HC, and H, I need a color for D. That'll work. All right, let's take a look at each of the products that come out of this. So from here, minus HA. When I pull HA, the base comes in. Pulls the proton, and electrons push in, and I will create the double bond in that location right there. So we'll draw that product. This is a minor product. That's the only product that comes out of that secondary carbocation. Then there are three different products that come out of the tertiary carbocation. So I can have minus HB, minus HC, and minus HD. Let's do HB first. So when I look at HB, the base is going to come in, pull the proton, electrons are going to push in, and I'm going to get a double bond, which is going to result right here between the two methyl groups. So I get the double bond between the methyl groups. That's one product. Second product, pulling HB. HC, as I pull it, base comes in, pulls the proton, electrons kick in. Bond is going to go here from the ring to the upwards methyl. That will be my double bond. Stereocenter unaffected. And the last one, pulling HD, as I go in and the base pulls that proton, electrons push in, and the double bond will be generated on this part of the ring portion between the methyl and the isopropenyl. And the stereocenter will be lost So there will be no backwards or forwards bond. It will be a straight bond because it will be on an sp2 hybridized carbon once that double bond is formed. So I get the double bond there, a straight bond, loss of the stereocenter, the methyl, and the other methyl there. So we've got four different products. One of these three is major, and we need to go back and look and figure out which one is major. To figure out which one is major, we're going to look at the substitution pattern and look at our temperature to consider substitution pattern. So let's choose maybe hot pink to look at substitution pattern. One, two, three, four. That's a tetra substituted. One, two, disubstituted. One, two, three, four. That's a tetra substituted. So it looks like I've got two tetra substituteds. The disubstituted, I think we can already relegate to minor. But between the two tetra substituteds, let's go look at our temp, 60 degrees. The boiling point of methanol is 68. This is a fairly high temp. So this high temperature, that's pushing me towards kinetic, or thermodynamic, sorry. And so between these two tetra substituted products, one of them is more stable than the other. And I don't know if we have enough information or if I've given you enough information yet to decide which one of these is the more important, more stable product.
Can I take a guess at it?
Yeah, go for it.
Wouldn't the product from the HD be the more stable product because it has the larger conjugated sp2 system?
Correct. It is the conjugation. Good call, Eric. Very nicely done. It's the conjugation system. That conjugation leads to greater stability. The more conjugation there is within a product, the more stable the product is. So when you can get a conjugated double bond, the more stable double bond is the conjugated double bond. So what we're looking at in conjugation is we're looking at sp2 to sp2 to sp2 to sp2. This is a conjugated system in here that acts like one big pi bond, one big diene, making this more stable. The other system goes sp2 to sp2 to sp3 to sp2 to sp2. It has an sp3 hybridized carbon in the center that prohibits these two from having resonance or interlinking, from being conjugated. It's what's called an isolated system, and the isolated systems are less stable. So this one over here is tet substituted and conjugated, and it's that conjugated component that makes this one the major and the other one the minor. So so we have four products, one major and three minor. And so we can finish out this reaction. Let's grab it. Let's put it down here. And we can draw out now our different products. Double bond here. This is from the one that does not experience the shift, minor, plus the double bond here. Plus the double bond there. Plus the one that actually gives us the major. And so we get major and minor and minor. And these three from a 1-2 alkyl shift. And the first one from the original carbocation. And these are all E1 in nature. Okay, how did that go? How did you guys followed along with what we did there, where everything came from? and this way of sort of blocking everything out, that this is a 1-2 alkyl shift that allowed that to occur at. Cool. Okay. The other thing I had was epoxides. However, we covered epoxides in lecture to a fairly good degree. And I think I did a better job with the epoxides in lecture than the epoxide reaction that I covered in lab. So I don't think I need to repeat the epoxide component. I can do a different epoxide maybe. Maybe that's what I ought to do. Let's create a different epoxide problem. So this epoxide problem was primarily an SN2 that I had. Let's do this. This is looking like such a weird. Let's leave it at that. That looks good. And let's do this with potassium tert butoxide and tertiary butanol. And let's do it at 0 degrees Celsius. And this epoxide that I've drawn, I've given you a certain or specific stereoisomer of this epoxide. Another way that we might draw this is to take and just draw the epoxide. Put the methyl groups there such that it looks like this, and that we would have the stereochemistry that way. Maybe what I would do is then put this methyl group back. So this is the other way that this epoxide could be drawn or could be represented, and these are the same representations. It's just rotating the group slightly to look at it in a different way and not showing that hydrogen that is attached to the epoxide itself. Okay, so without worrying about the substrate, let's look at the reagents and see what the reagents are telling me in terms of what type of reaction I might be considering here. So when I look at these reagents, I've got potassium tert butoxide. What is that? How do we classify that? What is that reagent? Is that a nucleophile? Is that a base? What is that?
Bulky base.
Yes, that's a bulky base. Good. And when I have a bulky base, what sort of reaction am I considering to the most part?
Eliminations.
Yeah, eliminations. But E1 or E2?
Well, isn't the tertiary butanol protic?
It is protic, but I wouldn't get too caught up in the tertiary butanol because it's a solvent of convenience. So as a solvent of convenience, the solvent is really not overly relevant to deciding the reaction mechanism in this. In other words, by solvent of convenience, what I'm saying is that when I take tertiary butanol and react it with potassium metal, that actually I just put a zero there, that reaction goes forward to produce the anion. The potassium is a cation, and I get hydrogen gas that comes off and it's how I make the potassium tert This piece is KO tertiary butyl. And so the tertiary butanol is there because it's the solvent from which I make potassium tert butoxide. It is not there in order to direct the chemical reaction in any particular direction. And so we call those solvents of convenience that it's just an easier solvent to work in. I could have done this in THF, and maybe I should have, but I always like to point out that sometimes the solvent is of lower priority and not really directing the reaction mechanism. So whether I'm going E1 or E2, the decision between E1 or E2, the differences would be that E1 would require that I have an ionizing solvent. In the case of an epoxide, it would require an acid in order to protonate it to make it into a good leaving group, because otherwise it's not a good leaving group. It would also require higher heat. And it would require a weaker base. The E2, on the other hand, in order to go E2, the main requirement is a strong base. It can use any solvent, protic or aprotic, and it can be done fairly cold or hot. It's a little less sensitive to temperature, but the main component there, oh, and it also does not require acid. Actually, does not require acid. It actually can't have acid because you're relying on a strong base, and a strong base is incompatible with acid. You can't have acid and strong base at the same time. You have one or the other. If you have an acid and a strong base, you've got a neutralization reaction, and you don't have either an acid or a base at that point. You've got a neutral reaction mixture. So the strong base is incompatible with acid. And so when we look through and flip through what we've got here, we've got a bulky base. The bulky base immediately puts you into the E2 category. As soon as you see bulky base, you should immediately think E2. Probably can't be mixed with protic solvents. Yes, that is true, that the bulky base generally is not done with protic solvents. However, Eric, be aware that we're in protic solvent right here, and yet we generated this base from the protic solvent. So it's a matter of I would not, here's what I would say about that. If I take a reaction vessel and the reaction vessel has in it tertiary butanol, or let's say ethanol or methanol, and I dump into this solid potassium tert butoxide, then what is going to happen, what is going to come out of this, is the potassium tert butoxide is going to preferentially pull the proton from the ethanol, and I won't have potassium tert butoxide anymore. I'll have tertiary butanol, and I'll have ethoxide ion. However, if I take and I have a solvent which is tertiary butanol, and I throw into this potassium metal, then the potassium metal reacts with the proton from the tertiary butanol to produce potassium ion plus hydrogen gas plus this guy. And even though there's tertiary butanol in there, I have an equilibrium between the tertiary butanol and the I have an equilibrium between the tertiary butanol and the potassium tert butoxide. And the tertiary butoxide is unaffected by that because it was generated within the solution. So while I generally can't have a different protic acid or protic solvent, I can have a protic solvent in that I have tertiary butanol as my protic solvent. And so so that's a clear thing. So anyway, this is an E2 reaction. So E1 is off the table, and this is an E2 reaction. And now that I've got an E2 reaction, now I've got to figure out what my product is going to be out of this. And so let's take a look at what products can form out of this reaction. So let's take this guy and copy that and look and see where there are protons that I can pull. So the protons that I can pull, there are protons that are connected on this methyl group. And I'm seeing an accident in the way that I constructed this problem. Then I'm going to get two products out of this that I, rather than the one that I want, but this will work. I think that we can make some sense out of this. Let's call all of these guys HA. Let's call this one HB, these guys HC, and that guy HD. Those, when I take a look at where the epoxide is connected here and here. These protons, the first ones that I'm going to look at, HA, those are beta to the epoxide. So if I say that this is the alpha position and the beta position, these protons are beta to the epoxide. In the same way that this is alpha and these guys are beta and this is beta, these guys are beta to the epoxide. And this proton here is beta to the epoxide. This one is alpha or geminal, meaning on the same carbon as the epoxide. So one that is geminal will maybe I should analyze that first, and then we can take a look at the others. So I'm going to color the other ones. Let's color these green. And let's color this one blue, and let's color this one red. Wow, got a lot of colors going on here all of a sudden. Let's analyze HB real quick and look at HB first. In terms of pulling that proton, remember that I must pull a proton anti-periplanar to the leaving group. So an E2 reaction requires pulling anti-periplanar to a leaving group. And so if I take a look at that proton and I visualize it in a Newman projection, actually I want to redraw because I want you to see the Newman projection that I'm about to do. And I'm just going to leave everything else here like that. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to look down this bond this way, except I want a circle, not an ellipse. Come on, click in. Still an ellipse. Yeah, if you want a circle, apparently, you got to draw a pretty good circle to begin with. Okay, that was a little bit better. I had to sit up to actually get it right. Let's put each of these groups, the oxygen up, the hydrogen HB on the right, the methyl group, the CH3 group on the left. That's where they go. And then the bond that is the epoxide comes in that way. And the back bonds, the methyl group that is on the right and on the left, is that group. Now, the leaving group is the oxygen. And the proton that I want to pull is there. I cannot rotate this because the three-membered ring system is entirely locked. And because it's locked, I can't go through a bond rotation to get HB anti to the leaving group. You can't do it. There's no way to rotate it because of the locked system. You can build it with your model kit and build a three-membered ring system. And you'll see that they're just extraordinarily rigid. And not only are they rigid, but they're in an eclipsed conformation. And they're stuck in an eclipsed conformation. And so can't be anti. And if it can't be anti, there's no E2. You can't pull it for the E2. So a proton, which is on the same carbon with the epoxide, cannot be pulled, cannot undergo an E2 reaction. Does that make sense? From a structural argument, why that's true? Okay, Colin's got it. The rest of you guys are following along? Eric, okay, Matt, cool. All right, looks like most people got that. All right, so that means that the other protons, they can become anti because I've got free rotation about those sigma bonds. So what I'm looking at is this sigma bond gives me free rotation. And I can get one of these protons anti to that leaving group. And that's easy to do. Free rotation about the sigma bond, free rotation about the sigma bond. So it is the beta protons that can be pulled. And they can become anti. And they can go E2. But not a proton which is on the same carbon, geminal to the epoxide. So that's an important concept. Now, let's look at pulling these different protons and see what happens. So I want to take, let me just copy this whole thing. See what we get, and we'll delete what we don't want with a bigger eraser. And I'm going to focus on color in terms of what I'm trying to do. We'll get rid of that guy, and that was a proton, so we'll leave him in there. Okay, so the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to look at minus HA. And so the base comes in, pulls the proton, opens up, opens that, and what I wind up getting is a double bond now there. HB is still back. The oxygen has now opened up. And I'm at this point, and then this picks up a proton from the solvent. So we can say this is, I think I was in tertiary butanol. We pick up a proton from the solvent and I gotta have enough room here to draw, but this product becomes an alcohol and has specific stereocenters in it and a double bond. And that's the product, I don't like my double bond there. That's the product that I would get that would come out of that. So that's minus H. A. Let's look at pulling I guess we can get all of those guys out of there, make this a little bit clearer. What color did I make those? Green. So let's look at pulling HC. Pulling HC, the base comes in, pulls the proton, electrons push in, this opens up that direction, and what I get is I get the double bond there, I lose the stereocenter, that becomes my O minus, and this is still a stereocenter with HB and the methyl group. This will pick up a proton. And so once we pick up the proton, this then will become a product that is the alcohol on a stereocenter with a double bond and that. And then what we'll do is look at pulling the last one. I think it just erased two things that I didn't really want to erase, HC and HD. And HD was blue, yeah. So let's pull HD. And pulling HD, that means that my base comes in, pulls the proton, electrons push in, this guy opens up, and I end up with the double bond in that location, the oxygen, the O minus. This picks up a proton and then comes down to make a product. Okay. Ooh, three different products that came out of this. And I feel like it's a little crowded. So try to make it a little less crowded. All right, three different products that came out of this. And we've got to decide which one of these products is major. So how do I do that? How do I decide which one of these products is major? What do I need to focus on? Don't lose sight of what base we were using. Go ahead, Eric.
Substitution of the double bond?
Substitution of the double bond is one factor, but that's what I was trying to clue you in on when I said don't lose sight of what base we're using. What was the base that we used? All the way back up here.
Bulky base.
Bulky base. Okay. So remember that we covered, where did we do it? I want to find it. I know I just talked about it. Here we go. Bulky bases, LDA, bulky bases can't get to the more sterically hindered protons. And so the bulky bases will tend to go for the less sterically hindered proton, giving you the less substituted. Whereas small bases tend to go towards the more substituted double bond because they can get in there and give you more of the thermodynamic product, the more stable product. So with a bulky base, sterics control, whereas with a small base, it is the stability of the double bond that controls. So we're in a bulky base, which means that what we need to do is we need to go down and look at each one of these protons that we were pulling and sort of assess the sterics around each proton. So what type of proton is HA? When I look at HA, what type of proton is that?
A first degree?
Yeah, primary. So HA is primary. And I'm getting a proton that is out, or a double bond that is out here that is the least substituted. So it is a monosubstituted double bond. So when I look at that, what I'm looking at is, I wish these things would stop popping up. Okay. The least substituted double bond is showing me that this is a single monosubstituted. And it was pulled from primary protons. What about HC? What type of protons are HC?
It's a disubstitute, or it's a primary?
It's also primary. Yeah, they're primary, but what I would say about them being primary is that they're in close proximity to this isopropyl group, and that isopropyl group increases the sterics around that methyl group a little bit. So there's slightly more sterics around that methyl group than there is around the other methyl group.
So should we recognize that?
Colin, this is the one where I said that I made a mistake when I constructed it because I didn't want to have this competing problem. And if I were to give you on a test, I would not give you two primary sites. I would give you a primary site and make everything else secondary or tertiary. So it was my bad. And I'm trying to fix my bad decision in terms of putting two methyls on here.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. So I would make it more clear. So this has more sterics around it. And this is disubstituted. It's happening here. And then this one, HD, is actually tertiary, and it has the most sterics. And so this is giving me a tetrasubstituted type of product here. But what's directing is the sterics, and this one has the least. And given that that has the least sterics, that's going to give me my major product. Because with a bulky base, it is about the sterics, about the proton, that is more important. And you want to go for the least substituted proton, or the proton that is on the primary with the least amount of sterics around it. That's what we're really looking for. So out of this problem, which started way the heck back here, let's grab this problem. And then we will put it over here. So out of this problem, what we're finding is that there are three possible products that come out of it. One product is the double bond, the alcohol there, plus we end up with the double bond, that guy, and the methyl group, and I always find this just tight enough that it's quite a bit tighter than a piece of paper in order to fit everything in the way that I want. And the last one is to get the double bond here. And that the major one was here, and this was due to bulky base with least sterics around the proton in the E2 reaction. These guys each were minor and had more sterics. Around the protons. And so that's our epoxide problem.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. How are you guys doing? How much energy do we have?
This is our last lab, isn't it?
It is. It is our last lab. This is a good one. While we're doing bulky bases, let's do another bulky base problem. This one has a leaving group, which is a mesylate. And we'll do it with potassium tert-butoxide in tertiary butanol again at 40 degrees C. Okay, so what do I see here in terms of this reagent, potassium tert-butoxide? What does potassium tert-butoxide tell me in terms of reaction? It's bulky base, but what is it reaction mechanism wise? Elimination, which type? E1 or E2? E2. Good, Nicole, nice. Eric, thank you for contributing. Yes, that when I see bulky base, the first reaction I should be considering is really E2. Everything else becomes sort of secondary to that bulky base, and that this is really an E2 reaction. So as soon as I decide that this is an E2 reaction with the bulky base, then what I start doing is looking and saying, okay, well, where are my protons and where is my leaving group and what's going on in this problem? So I have a group that is here, that is my leaving group, and there are protons here and here. So I'm going to call this one HA, HB, and HC. There are three different protons, and I know that HA and HB are the same, that they are on the same carbon. However, when we look to do an E2 reaction on a six-membered ring system, they are not the same, because you need to think about a six-membered ring system as being a chair conformation. And because of the chair conformation, what we have is we have two different axial HB and equatorial HA, and HC is up, and the methyl group is equatorial, and on the back part of the carbon up, this is the isopropyl group, which is up. And so when I look at this, what I see is that in this conformation, my leaving group is equatorial. When a leaving group is in an equatorial orientation, which proton is anti to the leaving group? Where is there an antiproton? In other words, let me draw a Newman projection by looking down. I want to look down this bond right here. And I'm going to simultaneously look down that bond. So I'm going to draw a six-membered ring conformation, and I'm going to look at HB and HA, and I'm going to ask whether HB or HA are anti to the leaving group. So let's do that. Okay, so, and I'm going to copy this before I start filling it in. We'll paste it over here because we're going to do some stuff with that later. Okay, so what I'm looking at is I have protons which are HB and HA, and I have on the backside, I knew I was missing something. On the backside, I have a hydrogen and the OMS group. And so I want to know whether HA or HB are anti to the leaving group. No, they're not. When I look at where the leaving group is, this is my leaving group, and both HA and HB are gauche to the leaving group. And what that means is no E2 reaction. This is true that when a leaving group is equatorial, it has no anti-hydrogen. this is a critical and important lesson. When a leaving group is equatorial on ring, there is no anti-hydrogen and therefore no E2 reaction. Okay, let's do a confirmation flip. So we'll switch to the next ring structure. And that will put the OMS group axial and my hydrogens, HB and HA, the methyl group will now be axial and the HC will be equatorial. Oh, also that group will be equatorial. Okay, so now when I look down the bonds, and the bonds that I want to look down is the same bonds that I did before, I want to look down those bonds, which means that I need to rotate everything, of course. Not helping me. Okay. So this goes up. It's kind of nice. It makes it look nice and neat when it snaps it all into place. Okay, so now what I've got is I have the OMS, the leaving group that is there. I have HB, HA, the hydrogen that is geminal to the leaving group. And then I have all hydrogens on this backside. I didn't actually get into where that isopropyl group was. That isopropyl group was here, and now the isopropyl group is there. These were just hydrogens that were on the molecule that were irrelevant to what we were trying to do. Now, I can ask the question, well, which proton is anti to the leaving group? And so now what I've got is I've got my leaving group, and I've got HA, which is anti to the leaving group, and only HA, which is anti to the leaving group. HC is never anti to the leaving group. HC and HB are both equatorial and can't be anti. So when I was looking at the leaving group over here before, all of the protons, none of the protons were anti to it. So there's only one proton that can be pulled, which is the HA proton. And as the base comes in to pull this proton, the base pulls it, electrons click in, that guy leaves, and I'm left with a structure that gives me the double bond in that position. And I'm left with the methyl there, and HB is still in place. And so this structure, oops, this was HC. This structure is the same thing as the six-membered ring system with a double bond here. And I believe that was up and the methyl group back. And this is the only product that I can form because it was the only one, the only conformation that allowed for the E2 reaction. So this reaction that is here and this product are what I get. Um, And even if I switch to a small base, it doesn't matter if I switch to a small base. The large base, the bulky base, allowed me to call this for an E2 reaction. But if I did this and did this reaction with a small base, and I got rid of this, and I did O sodium methoxide, and I did it in methanol, I'd get the same reaction. That small base, bulky base doesn't matter in a six-membered ring system when there's only one proton to pull. You can never get the more substituted double bond because there isn't any proton to pull to get the more substituted double bond. Does that make sense? That might take a little while to digest, but that's an important lesson for E2s on a six-membered ring system, that it's really about where the anti-hydrogen is as to which proton you can actually pull. So that's really important. And the other thing that was there is that when we were looking at this group, that anti-nature of this bond, that bond is anti, the other anti one is the methyl, but I can't pull a methyl. And so the other antiposition was blocked by the methyl group, and there was no secondary antiproton on that other side. And that's just a really, that's an important concept to get.
So just to kind of reiterate what you've been saying to make sure I understand it correctly, if that HA proton was replaced with, say, a methyl group, the reaction would not take place at all, correct?
The reaction technically would take place extremely slowly. So whereas we say that an E2 reaction cannot proceed when there is no antiproton, it's not entirely a true statement. The E2 does proceed at an extremely slow rate because the electrons can't dump into the antibonding orbital. And so the rate of the E2 reaction is many, many, many orders of magnitude slower. So it would be a lie for me to say that the E2 reaction doesn't happen, but it's so slow as to be negligible when there is an antiproton that can be pulled. So I think that's the answer to the question. So yes, if there was no antiproton, if there was another methyl there, we would say no reaction. That would be the answer that we would give, is no reaction. But this also says that we can do related rates. So this is a great question too. I hesitate to do this. Let's take and put OMS and let me look at, see what I want to do here. Okay. Okay. Let me open my window. It is getting stuffy in my room. I've got my door closed because my dogs were so barky. But I'm dying in here because this room is a tiny office. Stop, guys. And it just gets hot, and we're close to the end. And but this is an important question, is which one of these reactions is faster? And why? And what are the products? And this sort of exemplifies what we just went over. And in fact, one of these is exactly the same. So we've just analyzed, we already went through and we analyzed this one. So we've looked at this one already. And we know from the top reaction, in fact, it's actually more fair if I take and copy and paste. We know from the top reaction that I'm only going to get one product, that out of this, I can get this product. And that's the only product that I get. And out of that, what I want to do, let's call this one A, and this one B, and let's look at A real quick. And I know we've already looked at this, but I'm just going to draw it fairly quickly to show kind of what's happening. We had two different six-membered ring conformation states where I had the OMS and the methyl group was equatorial and this group was axial. And its conformation, its other conformation, where I have the OMS group in an axial orientation, the methyl group axial, and the isopropyl group equatorial. Okay, so those are the conformations there, and the reaction could only happen from this proton being pulled by the base, kicking electrons in, kicking that out, and that goes to the product. In B, the difference is, if I copy all of this, what is the difference in B? The difference in B is this methyl right here. So that methyl is opposite the stereochemical methyl in A. So that means that this methyl is actually in an axial orientation and in this side becomes equatorial. Okay, so what I want to do is we know that the proton can only be pulled when it is in, when the leaving group is in an axial orientation. So that means that both of these can, this can give two different products. So let's draw these products out just really quick, that this gives this product, where this is back and that is forward. We get only that. And this one gives two. This one gives this same product. And it gives the product where I get the double bond by the methyl. And so I get those two products. Now, to decide which one of these runs faster, I've got the products. I understand the products, but which one runs faster? You have to think back to six-member ring conformations and stability of these conformations. Look and see that what I've got is I'm going to track axial versus equatorial. So here's an axial group and two equatorial groups. Remember that the equatorial groups groups are more stable in their equatorial groups, and that OMS group is a pretty big group. On the flip side, what I've got is I've got one group axial and two fairly good-sized groups. Oh no, I've got two groups axial. There we go. And one group equatorial. So energy-wise, I am favoring this side and not that side. So this is the most stable. And being the most stable, what we find is that this is the major conformation. So what that means is that most of the material is over there and a little bit of the material is over there. Does that make sense? Just in terms of the relationships of where things are? Okay, let's look at the other one. In the other one, when I look at axial, I've got two axial groups and I've got one equatorial group. And then in the other conformation, I've got two equatorial and one axial. Okay, in terms of these conformations then, what that means is that this side is more stable. And being more stable, this is the major conformation. And if I were to draw that with a balance, with an equilibrium, that means that most of my material is over there and a tiny bit over here. So I'm favoring that side and leaning that way. Does that make sense? Everybody's following this argument so far? Okay, so here comes the big punchline, which is that the rate of an E2 reaction is equal to K times the concentration of our leaving group times the concentration of the base. So that the higher concentration of our leaving group, the faster the rate. That's important. The higher the concentration of our leaving group, the higher the rate. The first reaction, this is our leaving group. This is the concentration of our leaving group right here. That concentration is small. This is our leaving group for the bottom reaction. And this guy is big. So the faster reaction is the one where I have the higher concentration of the substrate in the correct orientation to undergo the E2 reaction. And so based on this, I'm relying on this concentration of our leaving group, and the higher the concentration, the faster the rate. That means that this is the faster reaction. So the products that I get out of it, I've got the one only. The other one I can take and I can draw my two products that came out. I get this product plus I get this product. And out of those two products, looking at the sterics wise, they're both about the same. I've got slightly higher, now what am I, 0°C. With tertiary potassium tributoxide, it really doesn't make that much of a difference. I would go for the more substituted one as being the major. We could argue that it's cold and that maybe under cold, I should get the slightly less substituted one because of the kinetic versus thermodynamic. But I'm gonna call this one as being major anyway. And this, because it's potassium tributoxide, and I wouldn't ask you that question, but this reaction is the faster one. And the answer as to why it's faster is detailed down below. So the entire answer to that problem is all sort of drawn out there. I'm writing a little bit bigger than I would normally because I'm trying to make it visible in the slides as we're doing it on the screen. I could do it in a tighter, more concise manner on a single page if I tightened it up a bit. But that's the argument that we make, that we try to make the argument based on equilibrium and the equilibrium of the chair conformations, which is the entire reason that we studied chair conformations and the ability to be able to figure out the energy of each one of the chair conformations. That figuring out the major conformation allows us to be able to use that then in other chemical reactions, such as E2 reactions, where you have to have the leaving group in an axial orientation and be pulling an antiproton. And the conformation that is the lowest in energy with that group axial is the one that is going to have the higher concentration and the one that is going to have the faster reaction rate. And it allows us to be able to do reaction rates or look at reaction rates based on energy conformations. You can do the same thing on a linear molecule as you can with chair structures, because we did the same analysis on linear molecules using Newman projections and understanding conformations. It all still applies. And in fact, we did one in lecture like that. So the lecture class, we sort of did that too. I just wanted to show it to you in a chair conformation. And specifically, I like using these balance beam sort of idea to figure out where I have the most material, because graphically it kind of hits it home graphically in a way that maybe the equilibrium arrows don't. So that's kind of why I like to use it that way. Just trying to give you some tools to be able to draw and write and be able to communicate more effectively where that major concentration is in order to figure out which group is going. All right, we have been working for 2 hours and 40 minutes. And I am just about out of gas. I'll take some questions if you guys want to do questions, but I think that was really the last example that I wanted to hit home before calling it quits today. And you guys, I know you guys have a lot of endurance and your brains are like sponges and we could keep going, but there's only so long that I can keep going. So let me, is it possible, let's see, Matt, is it possible to say reaction A is rate determining? When we say rate determining, we usually, Matt, use that rate determining as the rate determining step. We usually say that the highest energy step, the highest activation energy, is the rate determining step. What we could say is that that it has the higher activation energy, but we're comparing between two reactions. So we don't really say it's rate determining as much as we say that it's making that rate slower because it has the higher activation energy. That's really what we would say to that. So the language is more appropriate to a reaction that has multiple steps in it. So if we have a chemical reaction and we have something that goes to an intermediate that comes down here that goes to something else, that this step with this activation energy that is greater than each of these little tiny activation energies, that this would be my rate determining step within the reaction. And what we're really doing is we're comparing two different, completely different chemical reactions and their activation energies, both being E2. So what we're doing is we're comparing, actually it's an E2, so let me make it this way. E2 being like this versus E2 being something that has a higher, or actually let's make it lower activation energy. So this would be A and this would be B, and the energy associated with each of these, and B would be faster because it would be the lower activation energy. So it's not really rate determining as much as just has B has the high, has the lower activation energy. A has the higher activation energy.
So effectively the energy it takes to take the change chair conformations can be added into the activation energy.
Oh, God damn it, Eric. You're so damn sharp. No, it's not. And it's not fair. The drawing that I just did was not. No, don't be sorry at all. It's just, it was, as I was saying it, I realized the fault in what I was saying. And you caught on that so aptly. That was, and you were so quick to catch on it. That's a major kudos to you. I'm not swearing at you or being mad at you. You were just right on the money. And I'm just stoked that you're right on the money. It was just funny. No, you're absolutely right that the answer to the question is actually not one that the rate is not just about activation energy. That when we look at rate, that the rate is K times the concentration of our leaving group times the concentration of the base. And while both of these reactions have, so if I look at A has a reaction that looks like this. And if I look at B has a reaction that looks like this. The activation energy for both of these is about equal. And that's because it's baked into K, that K is proportional to the activation energy, that K equals E to the minus RT something. I can't remember exactly what it equals, but the activation energies are essentially the same for both reactions. What's different is the concentration of the leaving group, that it takes a chemical collision between two molecules. So think about cars on a freeway, right? So cars on a freeway at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's very few cars. The possibility of having a collision when there's very few cars on the highway is fairly small. But you go to rush hour and we flood the freeway with cars, and all of a sudden cars are banging into each other and there's all kinds of accidents and traffic slows down, and the number of collisions is relative to the number of chemical reactions. So when there are fewer products, when there are fewer starting materials in the solution, fewer R leaving groups, the reaction rate slows down because there's less collisions and less effective collisions. So it is not true that the activation is the only thing, the activation energy is the only thing that determines the rate of the chemical reaction. The rate is also proportional to the concentration of the products in the mixture. And we just made a concentration argument that this was a concentration argument, not an activation energy argument. So Eric, major kudos and 10,000 imaginary points to you in the imaginary game. Because you were spot on. The activation energies are not different, and the concentration does not play into the activation energy. The concentration plays into the relative rate of the reaction, just simply because of the number of collisions. So you were spot on the money there. I hope everybody followed that. And Eric, thank you for the question. And thank you for being dead on it. That was absolutely awesome.
I don't have any more questions. Thank you for the incredible lecture.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thanks for the good questions. And thanks for paying attention. Thanks for being on it. How about everybody else? Everybody feel good? Anybody have any other questions or anything? All right, let's call it then. We Thank ended you, with some energy and ended with some enthusiasm. So that was awesome. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Jason.
How's the final going to work?
Finn, I'm going to email you the final on Friday, and you're going to get it until Monday, and you're going to turn that final into me somewhere around somewhere before Tuesday. You're going to try to get it to me by Monday evening.
All right.
Okay.
Can you post the lecture notes from this morning? I kind of missed that class.
Yes, absolutely. I thought you were in lecture.
No, yeah, I overslept.
All right, no sweat. Yeah, I'll get those things up this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, a little bit later this afternoon because I'm going to go take a break right now, but I'll get them up before tonight.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, guys, if there's no further questions, let's call it, and we'll see you guys later.